Hello and welcome to the Gifted Podcast. I am your host, Neeraj Mulani, and in the Gifted Podcast, I speak with elite athletes as we try to challenge the misconception that athletes are just some people who are talented or gifted with special abilities at birth. Every week, I am joined by an elite athlete as we try to break down what it truly takes and means to be an athlete. If you're an aspiring athlete or just a casual sports fan, you will definitely enjoy this podcast as I get candid with athletes about their journey, their achievements, moments of heartbreak, and most importantly, moments of hard work and perseverance. Guys, I'm happy to share that the Gifted Podcast is now sponsored by Zenkai Sports, the new disruptor in the performance apparel world. And they have come up with a great offer for the listeners of this podcast. So stick around till the end and find out about this exciting offer. Today, I have with me Great Britain's Olympian in rowing, Stuart Innes. Stuart has a World Cup gold medal and a bronze at the World Championships. Stuart and I discuss how he came through a tough group of rowers and got selected to race at the Rio Olympics, where he finished fourth and narrowly missed out on a medal. Stuart also reflects on the injury setback he had after Rio and how that paved way for what he considers his biggest accomplishment, overcoming the injury to compete again. Stuart also shares how the postponement of the Tokyo Olympics in 2020 forced him into retirement. So let's get right to it. Welcome to the Gifted Podcast, Stuart. We're really, really excited to have you today. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. It's been a strange year, but it's good to be here, thanks.
Perfect. And how is the retirement life suiting you now?
Yeah, it's been a strange transition, particularly to not doing exactly what I planned at this point, but I think it was the right decision for me at the time, and it's still proving to be the right decision. Enjoying kind of doing slightly more normal things despite it being abnormal at the same time.
I reckon not waking up again at 5 a.m. and then realizing there's no practice.
Exactly that. Having a drink or two as well.
Perfect. And I was keen to understand, and I also read this in some of the interviews that were released after your retirement, where we understood that the postponement of the Olympics was one of the primary reasons behind announcing your retirement. How do you think this postponement affected or disrupted your preparation for the Tokyo Olympics? And what made you take that final decision of calling it quits?
So for me, I've spent the last 3 or 4 years rehabbing a chronic injury, and coming back from something like that is really defining. What I found was that it massively changed the athlete that I was, and it changed who I was as a person as well. Those experiences that I'd gone through and coming back into the sport, I felt out of place. I think the main crux of it on my retirement is that I couldn't carry on for another year. Medically speaking, I had put my body under a lot of stress to be able to do it, and in one kind of last ditch attempt to go for Tokyo. And I kind of always knew that it was a one-time thing, and I had one shot at this to try and get it right and to try and get that medal that I craved. And with the games postponed, it wasn't really a choice.
Right. And you had put 4 tough years into preparing for Tokyo, and then to decide to not put your body through another year of rigorous training and walking away from it. How tough was the call to retire for you?
Yeah, so it took a long time to come to the decision to retire. As it had been a really tough cycle, a really tough 4 years put into it. But I think what it really came back to was the place that I had been medically, where I was struggling to walk without pain in everyday life, really made that decision for me. And the point that I was at where I could train, I can enjoy kind of sport and exercise as I always have, but I still need to do a lot of maintenance. Like going forward, that's a good place to be in. But I was very aware of the toll that training 3 times a day very intensely was taking on my body. So that really took a lot of the pain out of the decision, I think, for me.
Right. And you'd mentioned in our conversation, as well as other interviews that I have come across, where in spite of all the achievements that you've had in your career, you always mention that coming back from your injury and being able to put yourself in a position to give yourself a shot at the Tokyo Olympics is your biggest achievement. Why do you think it's that for you? And how do you think you navigated that time throughout injury and bringing yourself back into contention for the Olympics?
Right. I mean, it's a really good question. Like, obviously, I had several pretty big landmarks in my career. Being selected for the Olympics in Great Britain when it's so competitive just to go. And I think that's something I experienced firsthand, particularly in rowing. If you get to the Olympics as an Olympic, as a rower in Great Britain, you've got a pretty good chance of a medal, and you have to be able to compete and fight for medals just to go. So that, alongside my kind of meteoric rise the year before, the speed at which I joined the team, were both massive achievements. But when I look back at my career and the place that I got to after injury, I think there are a large number of times that I wanted to give up, that I wanted to quit. And I faced huge challenges. And every day there was a new thing that was incredibly negative. And the emotional struggle that I faced there was really, really difficult to deal with. But the way that I came through it, and the way that I dealt with the injury, and the way that I did it despite the lack of help. I mean, there's parts of my rehab experience, parts of my journey where I was so supported, but there were also other parts where the system gave up on me, and the medical team told me that I couldn't fix this injury. And despite all of those things, and a year without having a coach or without having a team around me, to come through all of that definitely is my greatest achievement in sport, and something that not every athlete could deal with.
Right. And this recovery from the injury put you back in the contention for Tokyo. For one or the other reason, we know that that is not happening now. But even without Tokyo, you've had a very accomplished year, like we discussed. And within a year of breaking into the team in 2015, you had a World Cup gold medal in men's 8. You had a bronze in men's 4 at the World Championships. Tell me how this pre-Olympic year went down for you in 2015. And how was this setting you up for the Rio Olympics?
Yeah, so 2015 was a really interesting year. The year before that, 2014, was my first year out of under-23s. And that first year out of under-23s is a really tough time. If you haven't performed at the under-23 championships, there's almost this kind of phase where you're either going to make it or you're done. And I was very much in the bracket of, he's probably not made it. And so I had to make some really big changes to how I perceived myself and how others perceived me. So the year before that, I kind of said about the season, what do I need to change to make that next step? And as the season went on, it kind of went predictably. I was injured on and off. And every time I kind of went back to the drawing board and had another hard look at myself. And 2015, I hit the ground running for the first time. And I'd really made some big, big improvements in the gym since he was really tough area for me, where actually that was a large part of the reason that I spent so much time out of the boat. I was injured a lot. And to get that right, to build up a knowledge of S&C and a knowledge of myself and how I dealt with training, was a really important part of that. And so at the start of the 2015 year, as I say, I hit the ground running. I was stronger and fitter than I'd ever been, but I was also more robust and I could handle the training. And that started to reflect on the water and on the rowing machine. And I think it wasn't so much the numbers that I was pulling, but the improvement that they saw in me. And suddenly I started to get noticed for that improvement. And from there, I was noticed and brought onto a training camp with the men's senior team. There were a couple of guys injured. So there was that slight element of luck in there that I think everyone needs. But that element of luck, it pushed me into the men's sweep team. And the men's sweep team had won 2 golds and a silver the year before. And so for me, I was set. I had my heart set on the men's sculling team because everyone from the outside had said, there's no chance anyone's going to get in before Rio, before the Olympics happens. There's no way you're going to get into the men's sweep team. So I went on this training camp and was feeling pretty frustrated, but just filling into boats. And I didn't really think anything would come of it, but I was like, you know, I'll get seen. It's almost like doing a favor for them really to fill in. And actually what transpired was that I fitted in really well and I didn't mess it up. And a lot of the time in rowing, if you can fit in and look the part, then that's really important. So from there, that then led to this whirlwind season. And so it was kind of a bit of being in the right place at the right time, but also kind of aligning things with my training and starting to get things right myself.
Right. And your performance was evident across all the disciplines. So 8s, 4s, you know, doubles, everywhere. And I was particularly keen to understand how were you able to transition from each of these disciplines and keep performing across all of them?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. It was actually something that in rowing, it doesn't really strike you as that unusual. There's a slight difference in how you move each boat type and how you apply the power that you have. But if you have a good grounding in what you think will make the boat go fast, then it tends to work across the board. I guess the real interesting part of that is how we build teams, thrown into a new situation, how you build the team around you and how you get the most out of it. And I think the first part of that, my experience in the men's eight, a lot of that, I almost took a full backseat and just absorbed everything from the guys around me. You know, what can I learn? What can I take from this experience? What can I use as I go forward? Because I know that this is a temporary opportunity for me. Like I'm filling in and so it's just about being a sponge and seeing how much you can learn and how well you can fit in, not being the odd one out. And there were a few times during that experience where I was ill and I'd hide it because I was rowing with some of the greats who I'd grown up watching. And so there's weaknesses that you need to cover, but then there's also other things that you need to kind of amplify. So those traits and those lessons that I took from rowing with some of those guys were really important in my development and how I took things forward through the season. I think one of the things in my early career, I was really critical. I was one of the people that I didn't want to focus on what we were doing well, because we were doing that well. So we don't need to change any of that. But I would always focus on what hadn't gone so well. And what I learned from rowing with some of the best athletes was really that you need a much more balanced view, because other people don't take it so well, you just focusing on the negative things all the time. But that's just how my brain worked. And it took me far too long to figure out that that was the right solution.
Right. And it's interesting that you touch upon this team dynamic, where we outside looking in would always think that the coaches would be putting the fastest 8 single rowers in the boat and they'd perform at the top of their abilities. But there are a lot of other nitty-gritties involved in how to make the boat go faster.
Yeah. And I think from my side, it's something I talk about a little bit is imposter syndrome. And I really felt out of place being thrown into the deep end with all of my childhood heroes, the people I've grown up watching on TV and watched rowing. And in that boat, I think there were 20 world championship titles and 7 Olympic medals. And you're sitting there and you're kind of feeling really out of place. But for me, they didn't need that physicality. I mean, obviously it was there. Like everyone, once you're at that level, everyone has a very similar physicality. But what they needed from me was to slot in, not disrupt the boat too much and allow them to do their thing and to build that kind of team element. Like that was going to be the much bigger driving force of me coming into the boat. And I almost saw my job as just not messing it up.
Like you mentioned, physiologically, there are really, really less differentiators at that level. So it obviously comes down to each individual bringing a mindset to the table and eventually compounding into a really highly efficient team. So what do you think you were bringing to the table in that team, and what made you stand out in that team?
Yeah, so I think one of the beauties of being that outsider is that you're so enthusiastic. You're like a bit of a puppy. And I kind of bought that excitement that some of the older guys, through years of racing and training, that gets pulled out of you a little bit. Particularly in a sport like rowing, we train so hard. We train 3 times a day, 7 days a week, 50 weeks a year. And that kind of excitement gets ground out of you. Now, I came into the boat and into the team at the most exciting part of the season. We had 6 weeks until the first race, and I was just so excited to be there. And what that did was really bring excitement to these guys that were almost kind of battle hardened and had lost that slight edge to their competition. So to have that excitement and feel that excitement again, it really can have a big impact on athletes that have been around for a long time.
Right. And it possibly could be that excitement that allowed you to come out of that tough group of rowers and getting selected to race the pair at Rio Olympics.
Yeah, I think I came out of the eight, jumped in the pair and put in some really decent performances. And from there, got into the men's four. And again, being in the men's four, my job was, okay, the four wasn't going well before I got into it. And the reason that it wasn't going well was because everyone was at loggerheads. Everyone was arguing. Everyone had different ideas of how they wanted to do it. And to start with, my job, again, was just to not be as disruptive as the last guy. As long as I was less disruptive than him, then I would be successful. And that's how it started. But from there, I was then able to kind of input some of the ideas that I had, like slowly but surely, because I'd been less disruptive, I was then able to bring a lot more to the table. And you kind of learn to feed off the people around you. And I think that was probably one of the really key skills going forward. But also, I guess that the other skill from that season would be dealing with uncertainty. Like, I never knew what boat I was going to be in the following day. You know, I raced in the eight for a set period of time, and I knew that at some point I'd be pulled out and then bring the other injured guy back in. But I didn't know when that would be. So knowing that that was going to happen and that I was then going to have a chance to make my mark, I was always ready. And I was always ready for the uncertainty. And that really held me strong for the following year when the selection race got really out of hand. We were dealing with constant uncertainty and your entire Olympic dream hangs in the balance for 3 months.
Yeah. And tell me, how did you navigate that time of uncertainty when you don't know which boat you are in or whether you'd be at the Olympics or not, especially with that uncertainty in mind and having to, you know, continue performing?
Yeah, I mean, I dealt with it so well. I think the truthful answer is I didn't deal with it particularly well at times. There was one day where I lost something. I couldn't find my socks in the morning and I just got so angry. Of course, it wasn't to do with the fact that I couldn't find my socks for training. I just didn't know what was going on. I didn't know whether I was going to achieve my kind of Olympic dream that I'd held for 10, 15 years, or if that was all gone. And so I think at that point, I sought out the help of a sports psychologist and we kind of sat down and said, why are you here? What are you doing? Why do you want to do this? And just that really took us back to the basics of what we were doing. And so every day it was like, why am I doing this? And it's like, because I'm rowing on a beautiful lake and it's really sunny. This was obviously in the summer and we were going for the selection race. So the time of year helped and it's a dream come true and I wouldn't want to be doing anything else. And I think that passion for the sport and passion for just a love of rowing really, really meant that I was able to deal with that uncertainty despite kind of everything.
And what was the moment like when you knew you had qualified for it?
So the moment that we knew was at the end of our race in Poznań. And so we were racing off against another British pair and we'd laid out kind of the worst case scenarios. And the first one obviously was that we weren't fast enough or that both pairs were slow enough, but one pair, despite being slow, would end up in the final. Anyway, that didn't happen. But the second worst case scenario did. And that was that we had to race them twice. So we raced them in the heat and they kind of took off and were two lengths ahead. And we then rode them down and rode through them. So we were feeling pretty confident going into the final, but we knew we had to race them again. So coming into the final, we set off the start. And in my head, I was like, right, this time around, we're going to get in front because that's going to scare them. And so we got in front. And the race was going incredibly well. We were just half a length down on the Kiwis who had been 8 years at the top of world rowing and undefeated for 8 years. And at this point, we got completely carried away with the Kiwis, forgot about our selection race and decided to just go for it because no one had been this close. So we had 1,000 meters of fantastic rowing and then 500 meters holding on to the Kiwis and thinking, oh, we might have messed up the selection race here. And in the last kind of 200 meters, the other British pair was coming back on us really hard. So when we crossed the line, I was just so glad that the race was over, showing some serious inexperience or been slightly overzealous trying to race the Kiwis. But I think the moment we actually knew was when we were stood on the podium. And it was a really emotional experience from such an uncertain period before that. But the fact that race had gone so well and that the wheels had come off kind of right at the end gave me a huge amount of confidence and made me think that actually we are incredibly fast and we have the talent to challenge for Olympic gold here if we get everything right.
And was it at this moment when the mind starts to go in a frenzy trying to start preparing for the Olympics, even though we know the body needs a rest from that current race, but you can't convince the mind at that time, can you?
No, so actually the complete opposite happened. It was almost just like a big switch off, a big relief once you've been through something like that. I think it's very similar to if you've been working flat out in any sort of job and then suddenly you're on holiday and most people just get ill. Your body's been functioning at a really high level. You're working too hard almost. And then you relax and everything goes wrong. And that's kind of what happened to us. So we raced at the final World Cup. won the selection battle, went on the training camp, and were immediately ill, just, I think, because of the stress of it all.
And what sort of goals were you setting for yourself while you were preparing for Rio?
So I think we were always ambitious in our goals. I don't think you can represent Team GB and not expect to medal and try and win gold. I think we perhaps somewhat naively had set our sights on gold, and we were going to do everything in our power to try and achieve that. And I think given more time, or given a lack of the selection race that we had had to do, we would have had a chance at challenging that. But we talk about peaking in sport, and having to peak three times during a season, like we did, once for the Olympic regatta, which is kind of early season, but the kind of stress of at the stage in the team that we're at was really high. And then having to peak again for our selection race, and then having to peak again for the Olympics, I think that process really took a lot out of us and a lot out of the speed of the boat that we had, despite the fact that it was going really well. I think the physiological side of it was too much.
And this is commonly used in a lot of sports, speaking. I was really intrigued to know, what are the stages and processes of peaking? How do you control these? What are the dynamics of controlling this peaking?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that is really common, and you'll find across all sports, is that the training program is tailored to be really reduced, but only for 1 week a year. So if you have a big race, you train really hard, and then the week of, you almost just recover. So you still need to keep the body functioning, you still need to keep going. But if you try and do that too often, if you try and kind of taper off, so you're in the best physical shape, then you'll lose fitness over the long period. You'll be great for one race, but kind of going forwards, you're going to suffer. So in physiological terms, for a lot of the races throughout the year, we'd still train really hard right up to them. But for the Olympics, one time in 4 years, it almost tapers off to very little. And the athletes almost decide and dictate what's best for them at that point. I guess that kind of covers the program side of it. But in terms of the mental side of it, it takes quite a lot of, you know, almost forcing yourself to relax. You're so used to training really, really hard. And then you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. And a lot of our training is, how long can you put yourself in pain? Well, I think the period running into a massive race or a big competition, and when you peak, is getting comfortable being bored, because you don't have the opportunity to go and do stuff. Well, you don't have the opportunity to go and train. And then also you've got loads of time on your hands, but you have to lie on your bed and do as little as you can to kind of get that effect right.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And I was actually going to ask this question. I think you covered it already, Ben. I wanted to understand the mental peaking aspect of it, because obviously that's very counterintuitive to hear when you say that you want to force yourself to relax.
Yes. Yeah. It's one of those things. You'll probably be at your most relaxed when you are kind of around friends or going out to a social event. And that's really good mental recovery. But so the flip side of that is that's also tiring, and that's physically tiring, and physically something that you can't do. And so the forcing yourself to relax, very much like lockdown, is many of us have experienced now. You have to stay at home, sit on your bed, watch TV, and do not very much.
Right. And now coming to Rio, how was your experience at the Rio Olympics, and knowing that you achieved your dream of being an Olympian, and then having a shot at chasing down another dream of yourself, which is medaling at an Olympics? What was your experience like, and how did you feel narrowly missing out on the medal at the end of the race?
Yeah, so I think Rio was a bit of a roller coaster, to be honest. We went out to the games and knowing that we had a good chance of winning a medal if we got everything right. And we put everything together. We put together a great race. We were rowing incredibly well. It was really smooth. And one of the things that you forget about rowing is it's an outdoor sport. And when you have this Olympic dream, you have this idea of crossing the finish line, standing up and celebrating. And rowing in men's pair, you're very susceptible to rough water. We got out to Rio and the conditions that we were rowing in were crazy, is the only way to describe them. We had, the first day we raced, there were sideways white horses, and any other race that I would have raced, that point would have been cancelled in conditions like that. And being the Olympics, you just don't expect that. And so I think that really blindsided me. The form book almost went out the window on the first day. The Dutch didn't make the final, having been expected to be up there fighting for a chance of medals. We had our eyes on them as strong competition. And you rode out to the start thinking the conditions were one way, and you turn around and they were completely different. So there were quite a few curveballs thrown in. And I think that's probably true of anyone's Olympic experience, even if you don't have the conditions that were the big thing in Rio for the rowers. Even if you didn't have that, there's always going to be something that occurs that you don't expect. And it's down to you how much that's going to throw you. I think for us, it threw us a little bit. The first race was slightly strange, and we didn't row a full 2K leg between races because the conditions were too bad. But I think what really contributed to us finishing fourth was the selection battle, to be honest. I think we did everything in our control to set ourselves up well. And actually, the selection had really taken a lot out of us in the run up to Rio. And even after we were selected as the men's pair, we had the spare pair shadowing us the entire time. We trained with them all the time. It's like having a shadow behind you that hopes you'll trip up and fall on your face at any moment. So that was kind of a constant stress. Even though it was done, even though we were the ones racing and they weren't, there was that constant feeling, which was really counterproductive to performance. So I think crossing the finish line, there's obvious feelings of devastation, particularly as, you know, we were, what, was second until the last 200 meters, just kind of ran out of steam. But I think that really shows more the culmination of the season that preceded it, and factors to me that were out of our control in terms of fatigue going into a race like that. I think coming out of it, one of the things that I told myself was, you don't win a medal at your first Olympics, and that's what the statistics shows. So I was obviously devastated, but had a huge amount of hope and a huge amount of confidence going forward that my career was heading in the right direction.
Right. And what sort of interactions and conversations were you having with your teammate at this time?
I mean, we talk about everything. In a men's pair, your teammate is your life partner. You don't have a choice in that. We shared a room for months and months on it, and we talked about everything. A lot of it, once we got to the games, was about how we would limit our interactions with sport so that we weren't overwhelmed. Once you start competing, you turn on the TV and the Olympics is everywhere, and you can't switch off and you can't take your mind off it. So for us, we'd have like half an hour was the maximum we would allow ourselves to indulge that kind of, oh my God, the Olympics is happening all around us. So it was a lot about kind of controlling our emotions and not allowing our minds to run away with what's next and what's happening and panic. We stayed in a hotel two streets away from the beach, and every night you'd hear thunderstorms rolling in, and you're trying not to worry about how bad the conditions are going to be the following day. So there were kind of lots of little distraction tactics that we used in those interactions between us.
Keeping the monkey mind busy.
Yeah, exactly that.
And now having retired, and out of all the races that you have rode in and won as well, which would you say is your personal favorite and why?
Yeah, so I think there's actually one race that really springs to mind, and that was Henley in 2015. So after I'd raced in the men's eight, I came out of the men's eight and was racing in the spare pair. And we drew the South Africans on the Saturday, which is the semi-finals day. And it was a race that we just weren't expected to win. And it's a really boring race to watch, but we were down for over half the race and then we rode through them. But at that point, it was then really obvious that was kind of it. It was just one move for the entire race, and perhaps quite boring to watch. But actually, for me, it's what that race marks. And that race really marked my arrival on the senior international scene. And I think there's a line in the commentary that Stuart Innes has rode himself into Olympic contention in this race. And I think that truly embodies what happened in that moment.
Right. You know, you brought a lot of excitement to the team, and also your adaptability across all the disciplines was one of the key factors why you were able to contribute so much to the national team across all disciplines. But what would you say is the single biggest factor behind your success, according to you?
Perseverance. I started rowing as a junior and I had this vision of what I wanted to achieve. And to start with, it was I wanted to represent Great Britain at World Championships. And once I achieved that, it was like, right, okay, I want to go to the Olympics. And it wasn't something that I even spoke about for a number of years, but it was always kind of at the back of my mind. And I was never the strongest guy. I was never the fittest guy. I was never the most gifted, but I would always come back and go harder than anyone else. And I'd kind of think around the problem. And I think I had a knack for rowing, the rowing boat and the rowing stroke. We talk about boat feel. And that was something that I really saw as my biggest strength. I could feel what the boat was doing, and I could tell when someone else's movement or any movement was throwing it off or slowing it down. And so that really struck to the core of why I was able to be adaptable, was this kind of feeling of knowledge of how the boat moved, what slowed it down and what sped it up. And it also meant that I had some slightly different ideas to the crewmates around me. And at times I really struggled to get these across, but that kind of perseverance and that character that allowed me to keep going has been, you know, the defining characteristic of my career. And even as I say, my finest achievement is overcoming my injury. It's something that I don't think many athletes would have come back from.
Right. And I think I totally agree with that. And also the reason why I think you're a true epitome of the athletes that we are trying to have in this podcast, where we talk about the hard work and the perseverance behind the athlete, and not just the talent, not just the gift that they may have had at an early age in their sporting career.
Yeah, I think being incredibly gifted can be a curse in sport. I heard a story of two kayakers, one who was incredibly gifted at a young age, and the other, his brother, was completely useless. And the kayak club, you know, was desperate for this gifted guy to come down, but he wasn't very keen. But the useless brother was so keen. And so they got both of them to come down to try and encourage the one that was gifted. And if you could bet on it, then anyone would have said that the gifted kid would one day be the Olympic champion, but it wasn't. And the kid who was useless at the back was the one that became the Olympic champion. And I think that really embodies sport.
Absolutely. And one of these aspects, perseverance, is often talked about in the overall concept of athlete mindset. And I know that you are doing some really interesting work on that project around the athlete mindset. Tell me about this project and your aspirations behind starting this venture.
Yeah, so I'll just say in brief, I started a performance consulting and motivational speaking company called The Athlete Mindset. And the idea behind The Athlete Mindset is to share some of the lessons in resilience, teamwork, and perseverance that we develop as athletes. We make a lot of decisions that really shape how we come out as athletes, but also they shape our journey and they shape our lives. And we think about things very differently to your average person because of these experiences that we've had in sport. And so to share some of the skills that enable us to make these decisions, enable us to be resilient, and enable us to keep going almost no matter what, despite all these setbacks and despite crippling odds that I was given when I was injured. So to share these lessons with people struggling in work or just struggling in life is a really important message and something that I'm quite passionate about. And that's the goal of the athlete mindset.
That's terrific. And I think there is a lot of value that you are able to bring through this project, because like you mentioned, the athlete mindset, and it's such a universal concept that we see across all athletes. And that's why one of the reasons why we also see a lot of athletes then continue excelling even once they have gotten away from the sport that they were in, because they were able to keep relying on that athlete mindset to continue performing at a really high level. So I definitely see there being tremendous value that you're able to bring to a lot of other individuals as well as other aspiring athletes.
Yeah, thank you. I think it really takes a certain discipline to carry on with sport to such a high level. And I think this discipline really carries over into our personal lives. And we all have ups and downs, and coming out of sport as I am now, retiring, I'm going through them more so than I have before. So it's a really big change for me. But what I keep coming back to is this discipline that I had as an athlete. And every time I have kind of low moments where I'm not sure what I'm doing, it comes back to the discipline and the skills that I learned as an athlete to kind of break things down and think things through rationally rather than emotionally. And that really stands me in great stead.
Well, it's been a real pleasure having you today, Stuart, and we really appreciate you taking out the time today to share your incredible journey with us.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Wow, another amazing guest with another amazing story. Stuart's attitude all throughout his career, while racing or while rehabilitating from his injury, is very inspiring. I've had the fortune of picking his brain on some of his habits that allow him to perform to the best of his abilities, and with this episode, I hope the audience can also take away those learnings. Stuart regularly discusses this and much more as part of his new venture, The Athlete Mindset. You can find its website and other information in the show notes. As promised, here's more about our partnership with Zenkai Sports, the new disruptor in the performance apparel world. Zenkai utilizes a brand new technology that repels liquids, keeping you cooler during intense activity as the sweat evaporates naturally off your skin. This allows you to regulate body temperature easily and push yourself harder, as Zenkai clothing harnesses the power of your sweat. Sweat is our friend, keep it on you. Zenkai Sports is also the only performance apparel company which is cotton-based. All of their gear is over 65% cotton, with some pieces over 95%. Cotton is biodegradable, feels great against your skin, and is much better for our environment than synthetic-based apparel. Please go to www.zenkaisports.com to check out their cool range of products that can give you that extra boost in your performance. And while you are at it, use the code TGP20 for a 20% discount off your entire order. You can also find all these details in our show notes of this episode, so don't forget to check it out. So that's it for this episode, folks. Thank you for tuning into the Gifted Podcast. I have been your host, Neeraj Mulani. A gentle reminder, you can find us as The Gifted on your favorite podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, and Google. Keep following us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube as The Gifted Podcast, and on Twitter as The Gifted Pod, so you don't miss out on any upcoming episodes. Thank you once again for listening, and I'll see you next week with another special episode. Until then, stay well and keep your masks on.